It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk to comedian Jen Kirkman about dating post-divorce, experimenting with being a cougar, feminism in showbiz, and more. But first, what would Halloween be without a little bit of spookiness? Novelist Benjamin Percy has thrilled readers with his novels The Wilding, Red Moon, The Deadlands. He's also a reader who loves a good scare and a teacher who can break down the best techniques of the craft. His latest book is Thrill Me, Essays on Fiction, and he is with me today. Hello, Ben.
Hey, how are you?
Very good. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, happy to be on.
Well, let's go back to your childhood. When did you discover that you loved to be scared?
Well, I'm a big chicken to this day. And when I was a kid, I oftentimes was screaming in the middle of the night for my mama. And I know that one of the first instances of that came when I pulled off a bookshelf in the library the Universal Studios Book of Monsters and flipped through it and happened upon the picture of the Wolfman. And there was something about that fanged underbite and that shag carpeting hair that just owned me and paralyzed me. And to this day, for whatever reason, the werewolf remains just imprinted on my brain as, you know, the ultimate horror, along with, you know, sharks and bees.
So you were terrified. What made you like that experience?
I don't know what it is. You know, it's the way I'm hardwired incorrectly. It's, you know, it's just, I love, as Stephen King says, to dare the nightmare. That's the same reason that I love roller coasters. You know, even as you go through those perilous loops and dips, even as you rocket along at 70 miles per hour, that you're going to be all right at the other end of it. So, you know, it's a way to sort of safely appeal to our base desires and, you know, sort of safely work our way through the dark, the basement, the long drop, the tight space, you know, our fear of mutant albino cannibals or whatever. And, you know, it's just a way to, like, in these safety-belted, air-conditioned, helmeted times where everything is fenced in and so safe, you know, it's a way to experience something sort of primal, and it's exciting. You know, there's that rush of endorphins that gets unleashed in your brain when you experience something like that in a darkened theater or in the, you know, in your darkened living room when cracking open a novel.
You grew up in a very rural area. Was it easy to get your hands on the kinds of things you were looking for?
Well, my parents were rather strict to begin with about what I could about what I could watch. So I wasn't 13 until I was officially permitted to watch a PG-13 movie.
Wow.
But that's what friends are for, right? We all have that friend who, you know, has no rules, and I would always make sure I got invited to that friend's house. So, you know, I was watching movies like, I remember there was one about these killer slugs. I think it's called The Creeps or something like that when I was in second grade. I saw An American Werewolf in London when I was in third grade. and I was also at my parents' house sneaking books off of shelves. So my parents had a large library that included quite a lot of Stephen King. So it was in third grade when I first read It. And I did so sneakily. You know, that was my pornography under the mattress, I guess you could say, that I had these horror novels that I was sneaking off of my parents' bookshelves and into my room to read at night with a flashlight.
Well, so your parents must have enjoyed that kind of thing, too.
They did, but they had, you know, they didn't realize that I was, at the age of 9, you know, experiencing these R-rated atrocities, which has, you know, obviously made its mark on me now.
So when you were
nightmares for other people.
Right. When you were doing this in the dark against the rules, hiding this, when you got so scared that you couldn't handle it anymore, then what did you do because you couldn't tell your parents?
Well, I had this secret armor. I would wrap my cotton sheet around my body in sort of like a cocoon, and I just had this little blowhole for my mouth that I would breathe out of. And for some reason, I thought that that would, you know, keep away the vampires.
And it did. You're here to tell the tale.
And I have a particular memory of reading Dean Koontz's Watchers, which I haven't revisited, but back in fifth grade, I think that's when I read it. I thought it was the greatest novel ever written. And there's a creature in there who, in this one scene in particular, which I paid homage to in my novel Red Moon, this creature is tracking somebody through a house, and you can hear the click, click, click of its claws as it moves through the house in the dark. And I was in my room in the dark all night, convinced that I could hear, which is probably just my dog wandering around, but could hear this creature in my own house. And then I woke up at another point in the night and saw, like, this shadow, what I thought was coalesced in the corner. And I don't know if I got more than 15 minutes of sleep that night.
You also discovered pretty early on that you enjoyed scaring other people. How did you discover that?
Right. It's the same, you know, same sort of deal with bullying, I guess, where, you know, you get knocked around by somebody, so you knock around somebody else smaller than you. So, my poor sister suffered, I have to say. I spent a lot of time and effort terrorizing her. You know, I would leap out of closets wearing a demon mask. She had these troll dolls, you know, the troll dolls with the wild hair and the bug eyes.
Right. I think they're making a comeback.
Yeah. I would go into her room at night, and I would move them around. She had like 30 of them. And, you know, I'd line them up so that they were next to her bed and holding a note that said bad dreams with the R and the, you know, S backwards for trollish authenticity. And, you know, I'd put a troll in her cereal so that when she poured out her cereal, the troll would fall into the bowl. And then I invented this elaborate mythology about what I called the roof people. And I really hope to write a children's book. Actually, I probably can't write a children's book because no parent would buy this. But I hope to one day incorporate this into a story somehow. The roof people. This is this nightmare I came up with as a kid. And my sister, to this day, I'm very proud of it. She still sleeps with the light on, even though she's in her 30s. And, you know, the roof people are sort of those, it's kind of a purgatory, these lost souls. They live on our roof, on our roof, or they live in the attic, and they're sort of in this other world, and they prey upon the humans who, you know, still have life in them that they're jealous of and spiteful of the living. So
you had a, I mentioned you were in a really rural area, so you didn't have a lot of peers in the neighborhood, if you could call it a neighborhood, but you did have a family that lived nearby.
Yeah.
tell us a little bit about them.
The Marshalls, yeah. The Marshalls were evangelists, extreme evangelists, and they, you know, to the degree that when the mother answered the phone, she would say, heaven-o, because she didn't like to say hell-o. So she would answer the phone, heaven, oh. And that just sort of epitomizes the Marshalls. And, you know, a birthday party would consist of a Bible reading followed by a piano recital followed by fudgesicles. And I went out of my way, I'm sorry to say, to just ruin the Marshall boys. And I introduced them to, you know, smoking cigarettes and firing slingshots at cars on a passing highway and any number of terrible things. But I also, you know, tried to show them. I would, like, invite them into my house, and then I would have a horror movie on pause, and then I would play it just so that they saw some, you know, monstrous thing on the screen, and they would run out screaming. So I'm obviously a horrible person, as you can tell.
But it's interesting, in your book, as you write about interacting with this family, later, as you started parsing literature and thinking about what you'd read, you realized that you were sort of writing them into your own story at that point.
Yeah, I think it was training ground as a novelist. You know, I had a lot of time to sort of just, I wasn't supervised. I wasn't, obviously. I wasn't, you know, I didn't live that kind of life that kids live these days where every single minute of your day is scheduled. It was one of those families where in this Huck Finnish upbringing that I had, you know, you had to be home by dark. So I did as I wanted. And a lot of that time was, you know, in my I was in my head. I was in this imaginative realm, inventing stories. And sometimes I would draw in neighbors or my sister or, you know, my trusty sidekick, our dog, into the narrative. So I think that, absolutely, having that much free time and just being utterly bored helped me become the writer that I am today.
So you write a lot about when you first started taking writing classes, and you loved to read, you loved to write, but the idea of studying literature and studying writing as a craft was something that kind of came to you late. So you're sitting in a writing class, and the teacher says, you know, gives you an assignment and tells you no genre.
And I grew up thinking that that's what storytelling was, you know.
So you only read genre.
All I read. So, I read stories about vampires and dragons and barbarians with woolly underwear and robots with laser eyes. And when I threw up my hand on that during that first class and asked him, what do you mean by no genre? You know, he looked at me with this dead expression and said, I mean no vampires, no dragons, no barbarians with woolly underwear, no robots with laser eyes. And I very earnestly threw up my hand again and said, but what else is there? And thereafter, I discovered what else there was. You know, I had no idea who Flannery O'Connor was. I had never heard of Alice Munro. I had never heard of Leslie Silko or James Baldwin or Raymond Carver. And I fell in love with literary fiction. And I was asked, not just in that class, but in every single creative writing workshop that I took, you know, I was told, no genre. So I read and I wrote it almost exclusively, literary fiction, almost exclusively for the next 4 years. And then something happened, and I realized that I had lost touch with why I wanted to become a writer.
All right, so for the rest of our conversation, it's all genre. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Benjamin Percy. His latest book is Thrill Me, Essays on Fiction. He is a novelist. He's written The Wilding, Red Moon, The Deadlands. He's also writing comic books and doing a great deal of other work as well, thrilling a lot of readers. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking to Benjamin Percy. His latest book is Thrill Me, Essays on Fiction, although most of the time he's writing fiction that thrills his readers. And Benjamin, we were just talking before the break about how when you started taking courses and learning about literary fiction, genre kind of went out the window because it wasn't something that was taught in MFA courses, Masters of Fine Arts courses. And so at what point did you sort of have your aha moment that, you know what, this can be literature too?
It was when I picked up this book called Thrilling Tales, and it's edited by Michael Chabon. It was originally put out by McSweeney's, a literary journal, and then collected later by Vintage as a book. And the idea behind this anthology was Michael Chabon assigned to all of the writers within it the kind of story that they would have loved to read when growing up. And, you know, Rick Moody writes a story about a drug that helps you relive your most your favorite moments. This is a dystopian future story. And Jim Shepherd writes a story about a giant shark. And Sherman Alexie writes a story about these zombie Native Americans who rise up against a redneck sheriff. And the collection is hit or miss, but I just love the message behind it. Michael Chabon was talking about how he was a bored reader and a bored writer. And this resonated for me in part because my wife was refusing to read any book that I had read. Because when I would hand it to her and she would open it up, it would look corralled in barbed wire. I would have scrawled all over the pages, diagramming sentences, breaking down scenes, and she would push the book back to me and say, you take the fun out of reading. And she was right. She was right. I had lost touch with sort of like the joy. I was so obsessed with what was underneath the hood. And what this collection, Thrilling Tales, helped me understand is that, you know, you can write something that is both compulsively readable and artfully told. And, you know, if I'm looking at writers like Margaret Atwood, if I'm looking at writers like Kate Atkinson, if I'm looking at writers like Susanna Clarke, who wrote one of my favorite books, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, or Dennis Lehane, or Peter Straub, or Cormac McCarthy, you know, you see that in these books you've got sentences that are so beautifully crafted, you could, like, tear any one of them out of the book, hang it on the wall, frame it, invite the neighbors over to admire it. They've got subterranean themes, they've got glowing metaphors, but they've also got a lot happening. And that's the most essential question. That's why most people read, is to figure out what happens next. So what I did, you know, was start to, you know, realize that my stories were, you know, they were choked full of pretty sentences and beautiful images, but there wasn't a lot happening. So I started to sort of mold myself after writers like Margaret Atwood in particular, or writers like Cormac McCarthy, where, you know, I was paying careful attention to craft, but also, you know, not forgetting about that dirty word in so many creative writing workshops, which is plot.
So let's talk about some of the elements that make thrilling fiction thrilling. In your essays, you bring out a lot of, I think, really interesting points, because, of course, when you read something that's thrilling and exciting, most of us aren't actually parsing it or looking at the craft. But in creating thrilling fiction that really moves you, one of the things that you wrote about quite a bit was to also make it believable and relatable. And I think that's, you know, when you pick up a fantasy novel or something that is designed to thrill you, sometimes it's not relatable.
Right.
But the stuff that's relatable is the stuff that really gets you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's something to be said about making the extraordinary ordinary. That's how I talk about this theory, that, you know, if you have let's say a George Saunders story like Sea Oak. It's about somebody coming back from the dead. Now, that's cool, but that's not a reason to care about a story. So the brilliant thing about Sea Oak is that the person who comes back from the dead, Aunt Bernie, you know, I should say that this is a comedic story as well as it is a horrifying one. The woman who comes back from the dead, she is coming back from the dead because she never really lived. So she wants to, you know, travel. She never even got up in a plane. She wants to, you know, have, as she puts it, so many lovers because she died a virgin. She wants to eat caviar and shrimp out of a cup. She wants to stand on a veranda with a sea breeze blowing over her. And she has this great undead rant that occurs at the moment she reappears in that living room, the living room of this house, with mud clotting her hair and her black tongue darting out of her mouth to lick her lips. She has this moment that is, you know, totally ridiculous but heartfelt. Like, we understand why this matters. It normalizes the horror. Now, this isn't something that, you know, isn't necessarily going to make you go, you know, jump back in fright, but it's something that is relatable, that, you know, you can come to care about. So, you know, when you look at any speculative situation, when you look at any, you know, story that incorporates fantastic elements, you always want that. You always want that thing that you can connect to, so that it's not completely alien, so that it's not completely extraordinary, so that it feels grounded in realism somehow.
Once you start to really break these books down, these stories down, and look at the devices that make them work. I mean, your wife accused you of taking all the fun out of reading.
Right.
Does it take the fun out of it for you now?
Well, I have that problem. That problem where I open up a book and I sort of see it in code. You know, I'm almost like Neo at the end of The Matrix, to make a super nerdy film reference. You know, when he sort of sees everything around him in digital code, he recognizes that he is in the Matrix. And I'm sort of like that. Like, I fall into a story and I'm recognizing all the component parts that are working together to emotionally manipulate the audience. But what I force myself to do is set down my pen. So I read the story or I read the novel first in order to be swept away. And after that, I go back, if I admire it, and I break it down. That's when I have the pen out, and that's when I oftentimes have a yellow legal tablet next to me, and, you know, I will go through a book. I did this with Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, for instance. I wanted to write a book that was, you know, a big brick that was several hundred pages long, but read like a hail of silver bullets. So I went through Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and I read it three times, and on a third time, I went through a yellow legal tablet, and I outlined every single chapter. And in doing so, I recognized all these elements of trouble that were carefully woven through it. And, you know, I put that map up on a wall and sort of used it to understand the story math of telling a thriller.
We're going to talk about some of these other elements as we go on here, but we'd love to hear from you as well. What is your favorite suspenseful thriller that you have loved, maybe returned to again and again over the years? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm talking with Benjamin Percy. His latest book is Thrill Me, Essays on Fiction. And let's talk about suspense, building suspense. I think that's something that we all think we probably just know how to do, but the best writers do it in the most extraordinary ways. Ben, what are some of the secrets to suspense?
One thing is withholding information. So we are terrified of the unknown. And Stephen King talks about how the most, you know, exquisite moment in any horror story, whether it's a horror movie or a horror novel, is when the character approaches that door, that attic door or that cellar door, and they've heard a noise behind it, and they're approaching it and reaching for the knob, and then once they open it, right, we let out a shriek, but that shriek is usually followed by laughter, and that's because we feel relieved. Like, whatever was behind that door, it wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be, right? Think about Jaws and how Jaws is a horrifying movie when the shark is just a fin or when the shark is just a shadowy surge of water. And then when it finally breaches the surface, when we finally see the thing, we go, oh, that looks fake, right? That's how every horror movie sort of operates. On a scene-by-scene and on a macro scale, is that you try to keep that thing, you try to withhold that critical piece of information as long as you can so that the audience becomes complicit in the story, so that they have to, like, push their own imagination into it and light those dark corners. Mysteries work the same way. You have, like, this critical piece of information that's withheld all throughout. And what I've also discovered, though, in breaking down stories is that usually there is a turnstile of mysteries, meaning once one mystery is, there's kind of an expiration date on mysteries. Like, a reader or a viewer can only wait so long to discover something. Like, The Telltale Heart, in other words, could not be a 300-page story. Right. We can only listen to that heartbeat underneath the floorboard so long before, like, enough already. So there's an expiration date. And once you uncover that mystery, there's another mystery waiting beneath it. So I'm employing this myself all the time with, like, comic books, for instance. I wrote this Batman story not long ago where, you know, you've got the Gotham International Airport and it's encased in this storm, and all the flights are grounded and there's flights circling overhead, and one of those flights begins to descend. And the tower calls out to it and says, you know, stop, don't, what are you doing? But there's no response. So that initial question is, what's going on? Is this a terrorist act? And then when it's too late to send up the F-14, so the plane lands and they've got, you know, the Port Authority cops waiting on the runway, and they're able to ID the plane right then. And so that's at least part of the mystery revealed. It's like, okay, which plane is this? And then the plane, though, it takes, you know, there's another mystery waiting beneath the surface. It turns off the tarmac and it starts to barrel towards the concourse. And then it crashes through the window and, you know, wipes out this whole atrium area and comes to a screeching stop. And Batman opens up the hold, and we finally discover what's going on inside, that everybody is dead. But they're mummified, and the plane itself is rusted, and all the wires are cracked, and the plastic is aged. And so the mystery now becomes, like, we know what's inside of the plane, but now we wonder, why has this happened? Not only do we wonder why has this happened, we wonder, is this contagious? Because Batman's hair begins to gray, and the lighting in the airport starts to go off, and people's watches begin to slow down. So you see what I'm saying is that, you know, you always are withholding information, but only so long. There's always a carrot dangling tantalizingly before someone, and once they grab it, there's another juicier carrot just around the next bend.
Before we run out of time, I would love for you to read a little bit for us. And this is from the last essay in the book where you give us kind of our takeaway message as writers, but also as readers.
Yeah, yeah. So this is from Thrill Me, and the essay is called Go the Distance. And it's all about just being bullheaded and single-minded. So a lot of people have talent, but not a lot of people have grit. And this is an essay about grit. So this is just an excerpt, a small excerpt from it. And I say, I know, the editor-writer relationship should not be thought of as adversarial. Editors are there to discover and culture writers, to coach them along. But that's just the way my mind works. Everybody is in the ring with me. When I was a new dad, I couldn't even go on a walk without eyeing somebody else's stroller and thinking, my kid's cuter than yours. So when I was first starting out, I liked to think of editors as all looking like Burgess Meredith playing Coach Mickey Goldmill, wearing ill-fitting gray sweatsuits, whistles dangling around their necks. And I like to think of myself working the speed bag or jumping rope until my heels blistered over. Is that all you got? They screamed. Work harder, you wuss. I was, like any struggling athlete, full of resentment and respect. I wanted to do better to impress them, yes, but also to demonstrate something to myself. I wanted to go the distance. It's like Rocky says, I was nobody, but that don't matter neither. You know, because I was thinking, it really don't matter if I lose this fight. It really don't matter if this guy opens up my head either. Because all I want to do is go the distance. Nobody's ever gone the distance with Creed. And if I go that distance, you see, and that bell rings, and I'm still standing, I'm going to know for the first time in my life, see, that I want just another bum from the neighborhood. So every day, I would spend 8 hours at the keyboard, and every week, I would trek off to the post office, weighed down by stacks of manila envelopes to submit.
That's Benjamin Percy reading from his latest book, Thrill Me, Essays on Fiction. And, of course, you've had a lot of success thrilling the public with your books, and they are literary. You are an excellent writer. I mean, you've taken a lot away from all of this training that you've done. Do you feel like books that are exciting for people and thrilling and scary, do you feel like they're getting more respect in the literary community?
I do feel like the tide is turning, that there's still this huddling of the wagons, you know, the circling of the wagons where, you know, it is forbidden to write anything that reeks of plot or reeks of genre. It's impossible to write something like that for many creative writing workshops. But because of writers like Karen Russell, because of writers like Kelly Link, because of writers like Lauren Groff and Kevin Brockmeyer, you know, who really occupy a kind of shadowland, a phantom territory between literary and genre fiction, who are neither fish nor fowl, that the conversation is changing. And what I hope is that this book, Thrill Me, you know, is a kind of call to action that helps people recognize, you know, that it's not just essential to write these gem-like sentences and these three-dimensional characters. Yes, that is, you know, of the utmost importance, but also, you know, follow the advice of one of the greatest professors I ever had, Barry Hanna, who told me best writing advice of my life, Thrill Me.
You also cite so many works of fiction in the book, and some that I was surprised that you were including, although they are thrilling. They're not the kinds of books that you think of if you are thinking of horror or this kind of genre book. I mean, you were including Harry Potter, for example, which is very suspenseful. So do we also need to open our minds and expand genre a little bit?
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm referencing the fussiest of literary short stories in this book, and I'm also referencing the popcorniest of box office films. And I'm talking about Harry Potter, but I'm also talking about Alice Munro, and I'm also, you know, citing a Johnny Cash song, and I'm also breaking down Batman comic books. And, you know, the idea behind this is that I'm not distinguishing between so-called high and low art, that I'm just interested in telling the best story possible. And, you know, those Harry Potter stories, which I have read to all of my kids and read myself just for pleasure, you know, there's a lot to learn from them. And
Ben Percy, thank you so much for talking with me today. His latest book is Thrill Me, Essays on Fiction.